Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Vanity Fair.
Listen, you be you, and I'll be me. Two little lunatics who fit like a glove.
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss episode 5 of HBO's The Regime. This episode is called All Ye Faithful.
Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
And later, Andrea Riseborough will be joining us to talk about Christmas at the Palace and the Westgate protesters who crashed it, and probably her character's death as well.
But first, let's do a quick recap. Yes, it is indeed Christmas in the country we're calling Genovia, and the rebels are closing in on the palace. But the Chancellor isn't bothered.
This is a self-cleansing process for the state. You just have to let it play out naturally.
Madam, you cannot ignore...
Shut the fuck up! Sit down.
The ministers plot to overthrow Elena using her mental capacity as a way out of the civil war.
Because obviously the whole point of saying it...
Which we're not,
is that if we did make her stand down, it would forestall further bloodshed...
And damage to the private sector.
Thus hastening an economic rebuild.
With the rebels at the gates, Elena decides to step down and make Zubak her successor.
And there is only one sensible choice. The foundling's heir.
But that all comes to quite an abrupt end when the rebels breach the palace and the Chancellor and Zubak flee.
Palace breach!
What?
They're in the ground. We have to get her out.
Is Agnes dead?
Did you see the blood?
Yeah, but she could come back from
out of
that.
Her skull.
She could be okay.
Sure.
I hope for her sake she's dead because I wouldn't want to come back from that.
You sweet summer child. I'm glad you're rooting for her, but
well,
no.
I like her, but I would say on the one hand I'm sad because that's the character that. I mean, that's the only character to like other than the kid, I guess.
Yeah.
But I also
the carp.
Oh, right, yeah.
The carp was set free.
Yeah,
the carp that was set.
The carp. I appreciated from a sort of thematic and stylistic sense how blunt and sudden it was.
Because like,
that's how it would be.
Unceremonious.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like anyone was even aiming at her necessarily.
Yeah, it was just a random thing.
Yeah, I did fully scream when it happened. Like, oh, no. And I, you know, as much as Agnes is the one to root for, I wasn't even that emotionally connected to Agnes. Although this episode, I think... having her almost get out, with you know, be one day away from getting on that plane and going to France and making her baguettes or her tarts with her son. I was like, oh, okay, this is something the upward trajectory of her getting out.
It's her last day before retirement.
Yes.
Oh, I know, exactly. She just bought a boat.
So I was like, oh, it was tough to see her go. But yeah, I do think we can safely say that she will not be running the regime at the end of this.
No.
But that it made sense dramaturgically.
Yeah.
It did. And
to
I
borrow
think...
a phrase from another HBO.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that it was even more tragic because my concern was that she wasn't going to be able to get her son on board. He's little. He doesn't understand. He is attached to Elena to some extent. But the episode brought him toward a sort of like, I don't want to be here. They're going to kill my fish. And I think I was like, oh, so that hurdle is now gone. And then didn't matter.
I saw her like Miss Saigon style, like pushing him onto a helicopter. Right.
And waving goodbye.
And like not making it herself.
Right. But wasn't meant to be.
Wasn't meant to be. But I mean, Oscar, what happened to him at the end of the episode? He's
under that chair.
I'm
very worried.
I am very worried.
Maybe he takes over because people think that that's her son. Mm. And so he's the heir apparent. I mean, it's not a monarchy, but you know. Yeah. I mean, I think overall, I was a little surprised, and I'm curious to hear what you two think, that we got to this point. I guess it is the penultimate episode, but it felt like, where do they go from here now?
Well, no, I think I disagree, because like you, I mean, the penultimate episode is often when the real stuff
happens. Game of Thrones, famously,
when the big event goes down, and then the next episode is kind of fallout, and resetting the stage or whatever. So that made sense to me, and if it had ended here, then I do want to know where Elena and Zubak end up. I mean, not that I don't care if they live, but I want to know.
Right. Oh, I do too. Yeah.
I'm curious. I was just so happy. I was a little bit like, finally, like, you know, the chickens have come home to roost. Mm-hmm. Get this Westgate rebel army in here. I mean, I'm not to root for a literal coup and the death of Agnes and violence, but it was to see reality take over the palace and them having to come to grips with, oh, the people are rioting. Do you hear the people saying, Les Miserables? Let's burn this thing to the ground. I was quite engaged and excited. And I do think that we're going to see sort of in the next episode, the dust will settle. And like, what do they do now? Like, how do you respond to that? And,
yeah, I'm glad. I think the show has been a slow build, but that because of that, because it took so long to get to this point, it is satisfying to get to this point.
Yeah, it was satisfying. Yeah, there was a real satisfaction in like, when they pushed that dead man, her dead dad, off of the balcony and the coffin just exploded, I was like, finally.
I guess what I was surprised by was I think because of the cynicism of the show, I thought that somehow they would have not avert it entirely, but there would be some sort of like temporary rescue or something. Mm-hmm. You know, because like in the episode, they had like the little words at the bottom of the screen saying how close the forces were. Mm-hmm. And it was like, oh, there's this inevitable march. I thought something would stop it. And it was like, oh, no, they are just, there was no stopping it. And that's what I think I was like, because now Elena and Zubak are so trapped.
Yeah.
They've been kicked out of the helicopter by...
they're going underground because there's nowhere else to go.
Oh, we do know that...
The tunnels.
Yeah, exactly.
There are tunnels. So, where Hugh Grant was.
Yeah. Oh, and speaking of the tunnels, are we to understand that Nikki is actually in prison and that they're faking his addresses from, like, quote-unquote Switzerland, or am I going, like, galaxy brain?
Did he
actually get out?
Well, the thing is, I fully assumed that he was, like, in prison a la Kiplinger. And what is that was all faked,
right?
But then when they're running through the underground, I didn't see him. So
I would be such a good model citizen of this unnamed name of Genovia, because I totally was like, oh, he's in such a
he definitely is.
It didn't even cross my mind that it was fake, partly because the sort of advisors were like, oh, he's so fucking lucky. Mm-hmm. And you know, they revealed,
but did they even
know
where Kiplinger was? Like, did
that's
they
fair. Yeah.
Like, how closely kept was that secret?
Yeah, I guess my question with the Nikki thing was, if he really is in Switzerland, he would never actually come back, right? Even if they hadn't stormed the palace, but the tensions were that high, and she was like, "Hey, do you want to come back to Genovia and live with me again?" I feel like he'd be like, "No, I'm enjoying Switzerland."
Yeah, and he also has like a former wife and a kid that he could potentially go and find and run off.
I'm sure the wife would welcome him with
open arms. She's been just waiting by the door,
not moving, just for years and years and years. But no, I don't think he would return. I don't think we'll see him again.
He seems like he's still interested in Elena during that FaceTime call. But no, he doesn't. And ultimately, you know, no offense to Nikki, he doesn't matter that much to the story.
No.
We don't really need to see him again.
Yeah.
See him again, that would make sense.
I feel like there would be some little, like, button for him in the final episode where he's, like, in Switzerland and, like, some little thing's annoying him and he realizes that he's not, like, the husband of a dictator anymore, so he can't, like, have them killed or something. Yeah.
Building his poetry centers and whatnot. But this episode, it's so clear. And I think something that I have struggled with the whole show that hasn't really come to life is that this is a pot to do between Herbert and Elena. Like, it really, as much as it is a character study about, like, wow, Elena is a ridiculous dictator who is not in touch with reality, it's also about her psychosexual relationship with this also mentally ill corporal, and seeing them sort of, it's just the two of them, them against the world at this point. I am curious to see whether they end up together or not. It seems to be way more about them than I think I thought going into it.
Which is funny also. I read a review. I can't remember who made this comparison. It's possible it was more than one person, but it hadn't occurred to me when I read it. I was like, oh, this is so on point that this is basically a redo of The Idol.
Oh my God. Like, but
where it's
swapped.
A story about the weird power dynamic between a powerful woman and a weird guy.
Things go haywire.
And, like, who really has the upper hand.
And then they inexplicably end up together at the end.
So who from the regime is going to win an Oscar next year? Who's the Davine?
Fair enough. Yeah, I'm curious about the Elena Zubek of it all. I mean, like, I think, like, it seems more and more that, like, he functions as, like, her fraught relationship with the country, with the people of the country. And so I'm wondering if, again, maybe I'm too gullible, but, like, did you, either of you genuinely believe before she did the press conference, like, in that moment where she was like, wait, I know what to do, we give it to you, do you think she meant it then?
I think she thought she did.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah.
And Kate Winslet is such a good actress that, like, I believed her. Mm-hmm. And in that moment that, she really loves this man. This is a way to save them both. She's having this come to Jesus moment of self-reflection, and she can atone for her sins if she gives the country back to who the country belongs to. But then seeing her completely falter the last second and not give the country back to Zubek and not make him the new chancellor, I was like, oh, of course, people who are in power, they never give the power back. Like, that was never going to happen. And I mean, I think that's a testament to Winslet's performance, being able to sell it as, like, an actual potential, this might happen, and then directly just yank it back in such a precise way.
And it's totally anathema to someone like that to actually believe that the end is here, you know? Like, she...
You don't think that was a little overdone, her just complete delusion that, like, the rebels would actually get to the palace?
They set her up to be so delusional over the course of the series that I was like, oh, this actually does scan for her.
Yeah. And you know,
it strained my, you know, suspension of disbelief.
That's fair.
I think there were a few things this episode like that where I was like, okay, this feels a little bit more like a sort of contrivance than, you know, like, I thought the stuff with the painting, the way she reacted to this kind of childish painting was a bit like, the person being like, oh, I love it. Like, that felt very like, I've seen this a million times before. I also just had trouble in general with Zubek's characterization this episode between the painting and the dream interpreter.
Yeah, and the
like,
writing.
Do we believe, I know he was like into the whole dream idea with her, but that was a private thing they had. Do we believe that Zubek would go to this, essentially, a therapist?
I mean, you can believe that over the past 6 months, things have changed like the degree that
we
he
didn't
would.
See.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a little bit of cheating there, I guess, that we don't see that process kind of, or, you know, whatever changes he has undergone, we don't watch them happen.
Right. Real men would rather go to dream therapy than go to therapy.
Men would rather draw a child's, like, painting of the lady that they're sleeping with.
Oh, God. Elena's delusion and just, like, the setting of the whole episode, I do love when, like, the Christmas of it all, like, having this coup happen with the backdrop of, you know, sleigh bells ring, are you listening, and the presents, and just, like, I love, a woman dissociating and just being like, I'm just going to everything's hunky-dory, and we're going to put the mistletoe up, and we're going to trim the tree, and meanwhile, the bombs, honestly, this might be too big of a comparison. It was a little zone of interest where we're like in the Christmas world and we can hear the things happening outside just beyond the wall. And that willful ignorance, again, I love it every time. Like, that is something that's going to be compelling to me. Like, the ability for somebody to shut out what is literally creeping up at death's door, creeping up at their doorstep. I was here for it, and here for Elena, you know, being on a Christmas TV special, singing about carps and being Santa baby.
I'm glad to know that the Christmas carp is a real, like, Central European tradition.
Oh, is it?
Apparently, yes.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, you keep it in your bathtub until you kill it, because that's how it stays fresh.
I was literally how did they come up with this one?
There's a helpful story that our producer Emily included in the briefing.
Okay, so now you're calling me out.
Absolutely dragging me. Apparently, Jewish families would also do this before Passover, before they would make gefilte fish, as they would like put a carp in their bathtub. And I'm very glad that my family never did that, because you know gefilte fish is kind of a hard sell as it is.
Yeah, I've had it. I probably will have it Passover this year.
Well, thank you, Emily, for including that. Wow.
Do we think the Christmas special happens every year, or was it just a sign of Elena's like late stage Genovism? Where she's like fully lost her mind.
I like to believe that she thinks that she has to do it because the people love her so much.
Oh, yeah.
Like the Queen's address in the UK. Or I guess now it would be the King's address. Holiday.
I mean, I'm an easy audience for that. I love like the bad singing. Mm-hmm. I love the intentional 100%. Bad, like cheesy production.
The chorus girls who are always doing the same sort of kick, one, two. Like that seems to be their thing. I love that.
It's fun to think of Kate Winslet waking up, you know, wherever she was staying when they filmed in Austria that day and being like, oh, it's the Christmas special day. I get to put on the Mean Girls Christmas outfit.
And Regina George it up.
I would have watched that entire, if this episode had been stylized just as Elena's Christmas special, I would have been in entirely. Yeah.
I thought this episode did a good job of balancing that sort of, I mean, for the most part, there were some things like the painting that I was like, that's a little much. But like the Christmas special, some of the other things that were funny and dark. But then this episode also felt like it had real stakes. And I feel like that's kind of what I'd been lacking in some of the recent episodes.
Totally.
Where it's like, okay, so here actually is the world coming to bear on this. Do we think that in like the inevitability of the rebels storming the palace and all of this ridiculous like la la la, where it's just having a nice fancy Christmas inside, is the show issuing any sort of message to people, or does this show care about doing that? Do you know what I mean?
That's a good question.
I think
again, like it is broad enough that I'm not sure what the specific message could be beyond, you know, the very most obvious interpretation. You gotta pay attention.
Right.
Like, listen to people.
Yeah. Or like if you're some dictator or Trumpy figure in your, you know, gilded mansion ruling a nation, like the people outside are real. And, you know, and maybe there's a little bit of hopefulness in that in a violent way, I guess. I don't know.
I don't know. I was sort of struck, and maybe I was just watching it in a weird way, but not rooting for the rebels, but being like, oh, like they took over the palace. And I was like, oh, some of this imagery is very January 6th-y, just, you know, in terms of, you know, people storming a palace and just doing whatever they want with it. And I was like, well, that actually doesn't, if Elena is Trump, then, but the rebels are not for her. There was a little bit of, it's broad enough that it's not just like, oh, Elena is Trump and her army is taking over. It's a little bit more complicated than that, and it's not as specific. It's not as 1-2 as
The image of, you know, that like terrified anchor on state TV being surrounded by armed militia members. Like I thought that tableau was like pretty striking.
Yeah, no, and I think there were a lot of moments like that. I mean, when the people are storming the palace, I was like, well, that's a lot of extras, and they all have guns. But I think that the moral complexity of like who are we siding with? I mean, it's not really Elena, but is it really the rebels? Mm-hmm. That's, you know, we see them kill the one character that we sort of care about. At the same time, the episode is careful to point out that Agnes was a loyal, if somewhat scared, servant of this regime.
She didn't.
And she's talking to her son and saying, like, well, the French, you know, they're a little bit soft, you know, whatever. Like, she buys into this to some extent. And so, like, how good is she?
Yeah, to her ultimate detriment. I mean, it's kind of similar to the Keplinger of it all last episode, where he's like calling them deplorables. Like, that will be your death if you staying with this regime with Elena, following her blindly, which Agnes did the whole show until it was too late. And if you're not willing to come to your senses and smell the roses and see the writing on the wall, then you can end up just like Agnes.
You have to do a lot of metaphors before you, before you can get out of there.
You gotta get at least three.
And I think it's also in a sort of, you know, cynical way or whatever, or a pessimistic way, it's like, all right, if you find yourself in this situation, if you have gone along with this kind of thing, you at least have to be smart enough to know when to get out.
Yeah.
Because we kept hearing about all these other ministers who had left and they were the traitor this, and they're promoting the head of sports to defend, to, you know, director of defense or whatever it was. And the other guys, you know, at the round table, they at the very last minute got out.
Helicopter, yeah.
But Agnes didn't. Because she was more of a loyalist, I guess, in a way. Like, she maybe believed it more than those guys did. They were just there for game.
I don't know. I think her motivation is a little muddled. I think that it was... Because I don't know if I necessarily got so much that she was a loyalist, and I think it was... to, like, telegraph more that she's just scared for Oscar and does, like, wants to do what's best for him and doesn't know.
Well, that's right. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but we see her have multiple opportunities and she shuts them down. In part, it seems like for Oscar, but ultimately, I do think that that is a little
definitely
bit mixed
curious,
messaging.
Yeah, curious what Andrea Riseborough has to say about those motivations.
Yeah.
You know, how the Barbara of Seville starts playing on state TV, like, once it's clear that the coup is actually coming down. That
and Agnes mentions it right at the beginning of the episode. Like, that happened in the regime, like, in 1990, and that was the end.
And that was how they knew it was the end of the previous one. And so that, and, you know, its recurrence in this episode is a reference, again, to something from real life, which was during, like, right before the fall of the Soviet Union. There was a coup, and then that failed, but then the Soviet Union still fell. It was kind of like the first, like, stone thrown, but state TV turned to just showing Swan Lake, like Tchaikovsky, like, you know, a great example of Russian exceptionalism, I guess, was sort of the thinking.
Oh, I see. So the Russian state was playing that to distract
people. To be like, nothing to see here. Like, let's
we're amazing.
Yeah, we're not going to show, we're not going to show news footage of what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Oh, that is... oh, chilling.
I kind of wish the show had done a little bit more with the sort of surrealness of the media of this country. Like, we've seen it, obviously, with, like, you know, anchors just sort of, you know, saying the party line. And but then this episode with that, the Barbara of Seville stuff, and then this news anchor with, like, gunmen behind her. Like, I don't know. I maybe there could have been more with, like, social media. When Elena does her final press conference or whatever, that seems to be on Instagram Live.
Right. Yeah.
Right? It's not on state TV because they don't have control
of streaming.
That.
She's streaming. Yeah,
she's live. Yeah. So I don't know. That could have been maybe something the show could have explored a little more, is the regime's relationship to media. But maybe that's not for six episodes.
Yeah, I mean, and also something that would be interesting to the three people that are currently talking on this podcast.
Yeah, maybe just us.
Like, what's their version of the New York Times? Like,
what are they reporting about?
Is there a New Yorker magazine in that country? Yeah.
Yeah, there's the Genovian. Right, there's Genovia Today.
Who is Genovia there, Star?
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, our conversation with Andrea Riseborough, who plays Agnes in The Regime.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
So between, you know, the dehumidifiers, the potatoes, the just general presence that was Nikki, poor doomed Agnes, she really saw pretty much everything weird that happened in the palace.
Front row seat, really.
Yeah,
she did. Yeah. And she had a phone where she got contacted by people who wanted to get her out of there.
That's right. Mm. Yeah.
And she said no, and I still don't really know why.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. We hardly knew you, Agnes. It's really tough. But you know what? Luckily, I did get a chance to ask Andrea Riseborough exactly that question. Why didn't she use that phone? And we also talked about her time in the regime and her abrupt and sudden ending. Enjoy the conversation. Wow, Andrea Riseborough, I am so thrilled to be talking to you about the regime. I have to say, I this episode, episode 5, ended with quite a bang and a pretty sad ending for Agnes, I must say.
And also sort of in so many ways, she leaves as she came in the sense that she, you know, she moves through the building ghost-like through this very sort of protected, insular, very wonky, unhealthy bubble that they all exist in. She sort of moves around like a ghost through the rooms. Mm. And the moment that she leaves us is so silent and shocking and tragically subtle.
Exactly. It is tragically subtle. I mean, we were saying it's so not an event. It is not filled with fanfare. It happened so fast. We almost weren't sure if maybe she fell, maybe it didn't happen. And I think that sort of speaks to how violence like this, when it erupts, people just drop like flies. It's so...
The horrible, not always... faceless fallout of war, I think is what it underlines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we were wondering, and I was wondering, you know, we see Agnes, she has a phone, she has a way out. She's so close to getting out of the palace and to getting out with Oscar. And if she had just acted a little bit sooner and left a little bit before it all came crumbling down, maybe she would have gotten out alive. Why do you think she held on to the regime, to the palace, for as long as she did?
I think Agnes probably wouldn't have continued to be complicit working in the palace had her son not been suddenly found in great favor by Elena. And that just complicated Agnes's whole situation to the point where she found herself co-parenting with a dictator, which is trying at the best of times, and was unable to sort of extract him and save him from this very flighty, powerful figure, you know, and in any moment he could fall out of favor. So she's desperately trying to preserve his life, really. And in order to do that, she has to stay close to Elena and she has to stay within the palace. Then she's sort of trapped, essentially. The moment that she decides to make a break and flee, which really is the sort of decision, in a sense, it's suicide because so few people manage to escape.
Yeah.
But it seems like the lesser of two evils, you know, whichever way you look at it. And it's, of course, deeply unsuccessful.
That relationship, that co-parenting with Chancellor Elena is so... It's so complicated and nuanced, and yet so clear the power dynamic in terms of Agnes having to defer to whatever Elena's whim is of the week to keep Oscar alive. Can you talk a little bit about how you and Kate discussed that relationship, how you sort of found that? Because it's so central to Agnes's story and so interesting for the viewer.
We talked a lot before when we were shooting Lee. We were shooting a film before the regime, Kate and I, and as we were shooting Lee, there were moments when we just touched on having conversations about Elena and Agnes's relationship in what was then called the palace and ended up being called the regime. At the time, I made a film in Belgium, a French film with Catherine Deneuve, and my character had gone through chemotherapy, so I had a shaved head, and my hair was kind of growing back, just in its beginning tufty stages of growing back at that time. And Kate and I discussed the idea that perhaps Elena had, because of her own insecurities, requested Agnes keep her hair short. You know, that she's stripped her, as our own private backstory, that she's stripped her in a sense of her... of what was perhaps a former identity and removed kind of anybody else's, you know, she's so powerful and her, as much as anything else, her sexuality controls the palace. So that was just an interesting thing that Kate and I worked on a little, and that was one of the ways that Agnes was totally repressed. But I think just the thing that I really liked that we landed on with Agnes was that originally she wasn't really particularly from anywhere, and there was an allusion to it perhaps having formerly run this huge palace that they're all trapped in, and that there'd been a usurpation of her power by Elena, and so perhaps it was once Agnes's place. And we I suggested to Will that perhaps Agnes instead should be of, should be working class, should be, should represent in some way the proletariat, the people outside whose decisions are being made for them by some very disconnected people inside of this horrible walls. Regime.
Absolutely.
And so perhaps, because you see that in Matthijs's character, Zubak, you get a sense of the people, but he's still been harnessed as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And he's on the verge of real madness at this point. Whereas Agnes is, I'm pleased that we landed with her being, representing the working classes, because she's, through her, you get to see the long-suffering pawn, you know, in this giant game of political chess, who's being sort of most affected by these decisions.
I totally, even something that's interesting about the regime is all the accents are a little bit different. Like yours is, you know, a little bit more northern, and then, you know, Kate is doing her sort of Margaret Thatcher lisp. Interesting, such interesting work. But it all gives a place, a sense of place in terms of location and where they might fall on a class spectrum, which
and
I think is
hierarchy.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. That was the interesting thing about doing it with a British accent. There is such a horrible hierarchy that we, in a sense, through that accent, were able to lean on, through all of its nuances, we were able to lean on that hierarchy, even though it feels very Eastern European as a place, but we're in an imaginary place. So it's kind of, you know, it's representing so many horrific regimes. And so, and in it, part of why it's also so hysterically funny is because I think in it you see something articulated that's deeply politically familiar. It's not specific, but the ridiculousness of it is such that you can't help but laugh out loud because it's so inefficient and useless.
Yeah.
You know, the whole structure is so far away from any kind of social reform that it's just ridiculous.
Absolutely. And it is funny. I mean, that tone, I would love to hear how you as an actress sort of tackled that tone, because you're so right that in one moment it's, you know, kind of absurd, ridiculous, and we're seeing Zubak slather mustard on Kate Winslet's chest and, you know, rub it on her. And in the next, we're having these, you know, seeing a mother taken from her son in a violent coup. And that's a tricky tone to balance, to shift between the sort of absurdly comic and the truly dark and horrific. So how did you manage that?
Yes, quite. I'd almost forgotten about the mustard on Kate's boobs.
Hard to forget once you see it.
Maybe I've blocked it out. Will is such a brilliant writer, and the material is almost sort of Shakespearean in a sense, where, you know, it holds tragedy and a lot of comedy.
Mm.
And it's quite theatrical as well. And it's quite, there's something, even though it's set in modern day, that is quite sort of strangely period about it, in the sense that this country seems like a timeless, you know, geographically vague place.
Mm.
But I come from the northeast of England, which is a place that's very resilient, hardworking, very, very dry, cutting humour.
Yeah.
And Agnes doesn't come from that same place. She comes from a bit further south. But I think leaning on that world-weary, resilient sort of humour that comes from people who've multi-generationally been workers was very useful, playing Agnes, to strike that balance between total despair and sheer dismissal. And through Agnes's dismissal, that, you know, it's that, that's, it can often be very funny the way that she's beyond her wit's end with the situation that's going on around her. No, there's no sane figure to cling on to, really, other than the guy that she's sort of having a relationship with.
Yeah.
Peter. Nobody's safe, really. Nobody's safe, because everybody's in an impossible moral situation where they're unable to kind of behave as the best part of themselves.
it was so clear by the end of episode five, seeing Agnes sort of brutally and violently taken from us so quickly without any fanfare, that that was really who we were rooting for in the show. There's, you know, you can't, we're not really rooting for Zubek. We're not really rooting for Elena. We're interested and we're compelled by them and want to see what they do with this mess. But the heart of the show and the person that you're rooting for lack of a better word, is Agnes. So that... it was tough to see her go in such a manner because of that.
Poor old Agnes.
Yeah, I want to know, you mentioned you were working on Leave with Kate Winslet before shooting this. You've collaborated with her a bunch of times. She's a huge fan of your work, as has been documented. What is it like to work opposite Kate Winslet, and what's your working relationship now that you've, you know, worked together?
Just such a huge privilege, a joy, a total pleasure. She's just the kindest, loveliest, most brilliant, amongst many other things, leader. She's a wonderful person to have at the head of a project, because she sets the tone in such a generous and very playful way. And she's so funny and lovely, and every day has boundless energy, you know. And it's just wonderful to be in that environment where you feel like everybody is so muscularly engaged in, you know, finding out what could be the best possible path. When I first read the script of The Regime, I thought, and I knew that Kate was playing Elena the first, I just wanted to be in orbit of this, because I was crying sort of with laughter and thinking about Kate playing the part even before I'd heard her put a speak a word of the character. Just really, really so wonderful to see that come to life.
I will say, I'm excited for the final episode, but justice for Agnes, you know, I'll miss her. I'll miss her.
Oh, Agnes.
Still watching, we'll be back in just a moment. When we return, it's prediction time. We're going to make our picks for who will lead the regime in the end.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we are in our second to last episode. Next week, we are going to find out the answer to the question that we have been asking all season, which is who in the end is going to wind up in charge of Genovia. We have each been making predictions all season long. The winner is a high stakes contest. The winner is getting a one way ticket to beautiful Turkmenistan.
And you leave right
or
after.
Another dictatorship of your choice. I'm adding that clause. It could be right here.
I mean, I don't know why Richard is such a coward that he doesn't want to visit the great nation of Turkmenistan.
I don't know. It's so dry in Eurasia.
This time of year especially. Yeah.
But in any case, yes, we've made a variety of predictions. We've thought everything from Hugh Grant, which I'm very sorry to have been wrong about that.
Good guess.
To maybe Zubak, which
To Timothy Chalamet, even.
To Timothy Chalamet, who I cannot remember how he
came up. As Wonka?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for keeping me honest, Chris.
Yeah, we can't forget. We can't forget our predictions.
Okay. So as of last episode, you thought that Elena was maybe going to pull it out.
I thought maybe Elena was going to pull it out. And I'm actually, so I did some research this this episode or into history. I know a little bit about history too, inspired
not
by—
Not just a pretty face.
Not just, got some thoughts up here. And it is actually inspired by Learned League, for all you trivia heads out there. And there was a question about Nicolae Ceaușescu. I'm saying that wrong, but he was the Romanian—
A question that I knew the answer to because of this podcast.
Because of this podcast. And there's a question that I didn't know the answer to.
Ceaușescu, I believe.
Ceaușescu, thank you. Ceaușescu. And I did not know the answer. And then I like looked it up and I was like, wait, this is actually— there's a lot of overlap in that he was the Romanian Communist General Secretary. And he like held on to power until the end and was murdered by the incoming rebels. And I was like, oh, there's a lot of parallels to what's happening in the regime here. So maybe now I'm thinking, okay, I think Elena and Herbert Zubak, it's a chop. They're both murdered and dead. And
well,
I think
executed.
Executed would actually be, yes, absolutely executed by one of the ministers. So the ministers all flew, right? They're traitors, and we don't know where they went. Like, they're gone, but they could still easily—
That helicopter can't have a ton of range.
Exactly. Yeah. They're not making it all
maybe
the way
to— Maybe you can
to,
make it to Helsinki?
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, maybe France.
Where the other people are, yeah.
So I think one of those ministers is, like, working in cahoots with the rebels in, like, has some in and, like, murders both Elena and executes both public execution of Elena and Zubek and then takes power.
It's like Tom winning in Succession.
It's like Tom winning in Succession.
Well, one of the ministers mentioned his lake house, so maybe that's just where they're going.
You know? Hanging out at the lake house.
Yeah, I don't think the rebels are, like, worried about that.
The next episode is just, like, a big chill where they're just all, like, hanging out and thinking about the things that they did wrong.
And weirdly, Kevin Costner is playing a corpse, but we never see his
Kevin Costner was told his role was going to be bigger.
Yeah, he's like, I took time off of filming my Westerns for this. Yeah. Last week, I said no one was going to win, that Elena was going to start a nuclear war and just, you know, everything was going to end. Mm. That doesn't seem likely because I think she's not going to get her fingers anywhere near the button. I now think somehow in a more Game of Thrones ending, that a child, that a child takes over. I think it somehow goes to Oscar.
Mm. That was your original prediction. You're going back to
full circle.
Back to the beginning.
Oh, look at me. I didn't even remember.
Yeah.
A little optimistic too. I love that.
I mean, I don't think that this show is nihilistic or, like, cruel enough to kill a kid.
No, I was a little worried this episode, but it's clear that wasn't going to happen. Instead, they killed his mom.
Which is
fine. No, the storytellers since the dawn of time have been killing the mom so that the kid can like have an adventure. So there could be like, he's a Disney prince, I guess, at this point. Really a Disney princess.
Exactly.
Moana.
He's locked in a tower. His mom is dead. I think that you could definitely be onto something. I could see that happening. I mean, if he's— But the thing is that he represents the old regime, and if the rebels have taken it over, I don't think they're going to kill him, but I don't think they're going to keep him around.
Unless there's some sort of war journalist takes a photo of this little boy, the victim of the regime, weeping over his mother's body, and he becomes this sort of folk hero of what this regime
did. And we're back to media again.
And and then he goes on Brian Stelter's podcast. It's on the cover of, you know, magazines, and then the people make him the hero that they were pretending Zubak was.
Yeah, the emblem. Oh. Wow. And that war journalist is Kirsten Dunst from A24 Civil War.
Sponsor, but could be if they would like to.
Yeah. All full circle. Okay, I think I'm going to go in a different direction. I think maybe there is a power vacuum in Genovia now. I don't know if we don't know how well organized these rebels are. We don't know if there's anybody actually in charge. It could easily be
like a mob kind of.
It could be they're toppling, and now it's kind of a what's next kind of thing. They're, you know, Dustin Hoffman running onto the bus at the end of The Graduate, and they're like, well, we're here. Now what do we do? So I am gonna maybe go back to America. It's kind of been a factor in the show in the shadows ever since Martha Plimpton, you know, flew off back to Washington in episode 2. But I could see there being, you know, maybe this is the opportunity that, like, the U.S. government has been unofficially looking for to, you know, get a CIA plant in there, you know, get control of those cobalt mines away from China, which I'm sure they would love to do. I mean, it could go to China. Maybe that will still happen.
Are you saying the U.S. would cause political unrest, or at least to, capitalize on political unrest to put in some sort of puppet government friendly to U.S. economic interests?
That's never happened before.
I am saying mission accomplished. And
you're saying, si, senor.
Yes.
I think that I think CIA was sort of where you were leaning last week, too.
Oh,
I think that the what we know of this show's kind of cynical view of the world, and not, I mean, it's not really even cynical, it's sort of like realistic, that feels like an appropriately politically satiric ending.
Yes, mm-hmm. I don't think that it's going to become a utopian democracy.
No, I don't see. Like, I see more bloodshed.
Know that anything is ever going to become that ever again.
Yeah, no,
I think that's fair. I think maybe it's some mix of that. Maybe there's some combined thing between the three things that we're saying. Mm-hmm. Is the government reaches out to one of the ministers, like, can you just do the running? We'll put this kid up as sort of the hero of
the
it, but
now.
You report to us, mm-hmm. and we'll just go back to a corrupt state that is. Only better in that it benefits American.
Oh my gosh, are we all going to go to Turkmenistan together if that's that ending?
Yeah. I mean, roomies. Yeah.
But only one gets the business class.
Okay.
You think we can afford business class?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. If the Civil War sponsors us. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can send us any questions, concerns, theories about who's going to lead Genovia at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com, and we'll try to read the best ones on air. You can also find me at various social media, not mediums, at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Christris.
And I am at Hillabuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered and mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for the finale. Looking forward to seeing you then.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.